When it comes to playing in a band, everyone seems to come off like an expert. Many, many, many times, I've been given unsolicited advice by people who have played a handful of shows or been on the road for a weekend or who managed their cousin's band in college. You've heard of mansplaining by now, I'm sure, a recently popularized term to describe the innate male urge to condescend to mainly women, but not always, about the most inane basic stuff. The term should be commandeered to fit the music industry as well. Maybe call it music experting or rock-splaining, I don't know. But being told how to properly do things by self-ordained music specialists, be them managers, label execs, or simple comments on Facebook, makes one wonder why all these experts haven't managed to build their own U2s or Jay-Z's by putting their own advice to use. Sarcastic preambles aside, I think it's a given that everyone has an opinion when it comes to the music biz because everybody wants in, whether it's being a manager, producer, or band member. As a member of a band myself, I think I can tender some opinions gleaned from actual experience. And when I think about it, no matter how many claim to have been in a band or worked with a band, in reality, only a handful in comparison have actually gone through the process. So when I actually meet people who are in bands and who have been doing it for a long time and that we have a history with, no matter how many years seem to have passed between us, there is a shared experience that immediately puts us on the same wavelength, woven from the same cloth, and chipped from the same block, even though we may be very different people with very differing ideas. Recently, we completed an 8-week trek across Europe with Volbeat. It was a remarkable success. In the rock genre we reside in, Volbeat are its kings. They are a phenomenon that have taken everybody, music fan and music insider, by storm. They're an established arena rock ticket that only seemed to be getting bigger and bigger. I've known Volbeat singer Michael Polson since 2006. We toured America with them in 2013, and I sang on the song Black Rose on their Seal the Deal and Let's Boogie album from 2016, and that song went number one on active radio in America. So it was a great reconnection, hooking back up with their camp. When the tour was confirmed, we found out that alongside us as main support would be Baroness. Baroness are a band we've shared the stage with at a few festivals over the years. We first played with them in 2008 in Cologne, Germany for a Visions magazine event alongside Kylesa and Blackmail. And I had guitarist Pete Adams on this podcast along with Steve Zing and London May when Sam Hain reunited for 7 shows back in 2014, episode 81. They've gone through numerous member changes since our 2008 introduction, but I was honestly surprised to find out on the first day of the Volbeat tour in Newcastle, England, that we had already played shows with Baroness drummer Sebastian Thompson, since he's also the drummer for Trans Am. Trans Am, although not very active anymore, is a 3-piece, mainly instrumental band on Thrill Jockey Records that meld krautrock, progressive, electronic, hard rock, indie rock, and punk rock elements to form an exciting, very aggressive slash progressive, synthetically pleasing new sound. Honest to goodness, I lived by their first self-titled album, worshipped it almost, and their terrific follow-up, Surrender the Night. After that, I must admit, I didn't keep up with them, but not deliberately. I checked in with Future World when I saw posters for it at a club somewhere, but after that, I wasn't even sure they were still a band until Sebastian reintroduced himself to us. And what a pleasant surprise. Even though we only played a few shows with Trans Am back in the day, they remembered us, and we remembered them. Even bumping into Phil Manley at South by Southwest years later confirmed to me that formative experiences tend to stick around, and that's the shield I use when confronted by idiots masquerading as music industry oracles. When you have too much time to do something, aka an 8-week tour of arenas, the tendency can be to never get it done. But thankfully, we got this podcast episode done. You would think 8 weeks would be enough time to record a podcast chat, but it's also easier to postpone it for the next day and the next day and the next day, and pretty soon, you don't get it done. However, when Sebastian and I finally sat down to chat, all that deferring helped build anticipation, and this episode is a nice walk down memory lane as much as it is a current look at the Volbeat Tour from a completely different angle. I hope you enjoyed as much as I enjoyed chatting and touring with Sebastian. This podcast doesn't have any sponsors or merch. I do this simply to kill time on the road and to generally keep myself busy and because I like the sound of my own voice, in case you haven't figured that out yet. But I will ask if you guys could leave a comment on the various iTunes stores. It helps the podcast's profile, kind of makes it look legit. However you're listening to this, be it Spotify, iTunes, or SoundCloud, I thank you. So, without further ado, Sebastian Thompson, drummer of Baroness and Trans Am, is this episode's guest on the Danko Jones Podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones Podcast is the best around. They play like it is Danko's go out to love for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes get me in from fucked up. Stop playing, hang down, down. When the weather is bad and there's nothing much to do, take a listen, would you now, to what Danko Jones would do. It's the middle of the night and you better do it fast. Turn the speakers up loud for Danko's podcast.
They told him he was too crazy to rock and roll. But now, he's gonna talk their ears off. It's the official Danko Jones podcast. Danko's got a podcast, and he won't shut up.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready, because the Danko Jones podcast starts now!
This.
Let's do it. It's happening right now. We're doing it right now.
Sick.
First, I got to say, phew. God for you saying yes to this.
Danko and I have been on tour for 8 weeks now, and I've been procrastinating podcasting.
And then you bailed.
Podcastinating.
And then you bailed on the Regal Beagle podcast.
I did. I started, I will talk a little bit about Three's Company.
Go for it.
So I came to America as a five-year-old, and it was like, that was like 1979 or something. And it was on TV, and it was one of the few sitcoms that I did watch as a little kid. Because mainly I liked, you know, like cartoons and sci-fi shit or whatever. I didn't like sitcoms. But I watched that because it was like more sort of like,
Sexy.
It was like, you know, what's fresh or whatever, you know what I mean? Like
back then it was.
Yeah. Right? And I'm sorry to say, Danko, and for the listeners, we tried watching one recently, and I was just kind of like, I didn't find it very funny.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, it was Gina and Nick and yourself from Baroness tried to watch an episode because you agreed to be on the Regal Beagle podcast.
Yeah,
couldn't get through it. You guys found the sexist... The joke sexist and homophobic.
Honestly,
you were above that.
No, it was just, I just didn't laugh. I don't mind a bit of like un-PC-ness, but I just didn't laugh.
So you couldn't get through this 22-minute episode on a day off.
On a day off, because I just thought we would just end up talking shit on it like I'm doing right now. Which podcast are we doing, by the way?
We're doing the official Danko Jones podcast, which has been going on for 8 years.
Nice.
And I mean, I could run all the guests that have been on it if you need
a certain amount of
accreditation.
I'm sure I'm in great company.
You are.
Yeah, I believe you.
So we're on this tour together with Volbeat. We've been doing it now for 6 weeks, I think.
Yeah, you guys went home. Baroness stayed on tour.
Right.
So we started, it's now
8 weeks.
November 15th or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we started September 20th.
Kind of, yeah.
So this has been the longest official single tour. I've done a 3-month tour with Trans Am, but it was like three tours back to back. So there was a little bit of, there was like mini breaks.
Oh, right. So different bands, different people.
It was different. It was like 1 month in North America, 1 month in Europe, and 1 month in Australia and New Zealand.
That's enough of a break and difference, but you've been on Europe.
Each section had a different vibe. This has been the same tour for 8 weeks.
The same people, the same tour.
Yeah, same crew.
You see the same, my face.
You guys, well, you guys went home. You guys went home.
For 12 days.
For 12 days and went back to, Toronto?
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
So I'm losing my mind.
I got you. But hopefully doing the podcast will give you a little bit of a breather or you can reboot.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely, I intend to make this a walk down memory lane.
I'm into that. I'm going to need you to jog my memory a little bit because...
Well, first of all...
It was a long time ago.
I did not know you were in Baroness. And the first day of the tour, Rich told me that, the drummer from Baroness says that he toured with you guys, Trans Am. And then I saw you from behind and you have a ponytail and you had like a track top, like a tracksuit top with a hoodie, like a hoodie top. And I was like, no, that dude's lying. Yeah. He was never in Trans Am. Yeah. And then you turned around and I was like, so Baroness is where you landed.
Yeah, it's true. So, I mean, should I talk about that?
Trans Am or how you got into Baroness?
Yeah.
How did you get into Baroness?
So what happened was that, so Trans Am was, I never really had a talk with my buddies in Trans Am about this, but at some point they started sort of turning down tours and stuff. You know, they were just kind of sick of life on the road and or getting married and having kids and whatever. And I was still dedicated to, life on the road. So... luckily, the Baroness opportunity came when Trans Am was sort of slowing down. Trans Am is still a band, but it's not how we pay the rent anymore.
Right.
It's just three friends having fun and making records,
Which is what it should be.
Which is in an ideal world, with no pressure. So the Baroness thing, so basically Baroness was on tour in 2012 or 2013, the accident? I think 2012. I don't remember. Maybe 2013.
Right. Yeah.
They were on tour in England, and the bus lost its brakes, and then went over a bridge, and they all got pretty fucked up. Especially John, the singer, broke his arm in multiple places, but it got reconstructed. But Alan, the drummer, hurt his back and didn't really want to tour anymore. Mm-hmm. So John wanted to find a new drummer, and same thing with the bass player, Matt, and they wanted to find a new rhythm section. So. He called my buddy John Theodore, who, I don't know if you remember this, so Danko and I know each other from the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And when we were touring together, the guitarist in Trans Am had another band called Golden, and the drummer in that band was John Theodore.
Okay.
So I've been friends with John Theodore for whatever, 20, 30 years now? Yeah, 30 years. And so he was... also, John Theodore was also kind of in between bands. He had already quit the Mars Volta.
Okay.
And John Baisley called John Theodore and said, hey, would you like to play in Baroness? And John Theodore said, I've just been asked to join Queens of the Stone Age. Okay. So I'm going to have to pass. Thank you, right? I mean, that's a pretty good fucking opportunity.
Yeah.
So awesome for John Theodore. But John Theodore said, hey, you know who you should call? You should call Seb from Trans Am. And John Baisley was like, I didn't know he would be available or would be into that. Because I think I was very closely associated with Trans Am. I didn't drum much outside of that. So it's like, I was like, it was like one thing, in a sense. What I mean?
Yeah.
So John Theodore gave John Baisley my number. We talked, we chatted, I learned some songs. We jammed, and Pete... and John were like, hey, yeah, we're going on tour in like a month. Are you ready? I'm like, yeah, let's do it. It was that fast.
2013.
I think that, I joined 2013. Yeah, 6 years ago. Jesus. Right.
But around 2013 now, you're also in a band called Weird War.
Yes.
Were you in Weird War at the time?
I wasn't. So Weird War is Ian Finonius from Nation of Ulysses and The Makeup, and Michelle May from The Makeup. And Alex Minoff, who played in that band Golden with Phil from Trans Am and John Theodore.
Right.
So we're all old friends. So I made one album with Weird War, Illuminated by the Light, and we did a bunch of touring, and that was really fun. And I mean, as a drummer, sometimes it's fun because you get to like show off, or sometimes it's fun because of whatever you like about the music, but sometimes it's also fun because you're on stage with an incredible frontman. And being on stage with Ian was just entertained me every night.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, I'm just like back there, just like with a big smile on my face, because he's just, you know, he's such a good entertainer.
Yeah, he's one of the best.
Yeah. So that was really fun. But when Weird World was happening, I moved to England. I just sort of had like a life crisis.
You're still in Trans Am.
Yeah, Trans Am was still happening, but we were not. None of us were living together. For a while, we all lived in D.C. We had a recording studio. And then the other guys moved out of town, California and New Zealand, because of girls, as you do. And then I have a British passport because of my grandfather, even though I don't consider myself British. But I was like, hey, I have this passport. We sold the studio. I had a bunch of money in the bank account. I knew I had two friends in London. And I said, whatever, I just moved without really knowing anybody. And that, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, kind of, I think, was like the last straw for Weird War. I mean, it wasn't the main cause. It just made everything more difficult, me being overseas.
Well, I mean, was Weird War as prolific as the makeup and now Chain in the Gang to begin with?
Definitely not. And I think it was a little bit difficult for Ian and Michelle, because it wasn't getting the same attention the makeup got.
Yeah.
So they were like, it was kind of like a reality check for them, you know?
I was waiting for Weird War to take off too, because I had seen, like I told you earlier, I'd seen this early video of them. Yeah, it was amazing.
Cool. It was really cool.
I quickly realized when, you know, we met with Ian and Michelle, and they brought us to D.C. Mm-hmm. to play Cold Rice.
No, that's awesome.
And we didn't even know this was a real thing, because they have an album. And then we quickly realized that, like, everybody knows each other. Yeah. And D.C. is kind of like this mythological mecca of indie rock and punk rock.
Especially
to us.
In that era.
Yeah, in that era,
that's gone now.
To guys like us, you know, who listen to all those bands. And then here we were playing, and then Phil from Trans Am shows up in the front row, and he's fucking going crazy. Nice. And it was the craziest, one of the most surreal shows we've ever played, in front of all these Riot Girls and all these Nation of Ulysses guys and Discord people.
Were there white belts already there?
No. I can't. I have a photo of everyone who was there.
Nice. I was not at that show. I don't know why.
No, I don't know.
I don't know what I was doing that night.
But that's when, you know, things started kind of gaining ground for us in terms of American indie rock. But being from Toronto, I realized, oh, wow, like, yeah, everybody really knows each other. Yeah. DC's a thing and a club and a look and a feel and a sound.
But the thing is, like, it was a little bit hard for Trans Am because, like, we did start out playing sort of DC hardcore, but very soon after we started doing like the post rock, kraut rock, electronic, whatever thing. And that, I think, alienated a lot of people in the scene.
Really?
Yeah. And eventually we all became close friends. And I'm still friends with these people, but it took a little doing. We were seen as outsiders. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I can
for
see
a while.
As in sound wise, maybe. Like, you don't sound like Q, not you, or whatever.
Not at all.
But knowing Ian, he would totally get it.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean? Eventually, it became awesome. And we would do shows together and stuff with all the DC bands. But at first, it was just, we also didn't, you know, really fit in, maybe just stylistically. I don't know. Like, we also, I don't know. We also drank. You know, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't that strict or whatever. But I don't know. We were slightly outsiders, but it eventually became very welcoming and a very tight knit community, and really fun and a really good period in my life. It was a good time.
It was a great time in my life too. I mean, I think when we finally visited DC through Ian and Michelle, we had already played with you guys. And I didn't even know you guys were part of the DC scene.
Right, exactly. See, how would...
Through sound and also label.
Yeah, people thought we were Chicago for a long time because of Thrill Jockey.
Yeah.
But the tour that we did together with you and Six Finger Satellite...
We did a couple of shows together.
Yeah, that's a pretty sick lineup.
Yeah, and I have a flyer for one of those, the show.
That's a really high-energy lineup.
We did, I think, I could swear we did three shows together.
Yeah.
At least.
That sounds right. Yeah.
And you were interviewed at the time, the New Music, which was a national television show that spurned J.D. Roberts, who's actually on, what is it, ABC News now, as John Roberts, he's an anchorman.
Okay, yeah.
He's in
yeah.
the White House at the press conferences.
So he's Canadian.
He was one of the original hosts of this show, of this music magazine show that MTV was inspired by.
Wow.
Anyways, they were working on a story on us, and they interviewed. I said, well, we're playing with Trans Am this weekend.
Yeah.
You can talk to the guys. And then you were setting up your drums while they're interviewing you, and you said something like, I heard they're pretty good. I don't know. I was too busy, blah, blah, blah. That's what you said. I swear, if I could find the clip.
See, nowadays I have a drum tech. I could have done the interview.
Yeah. Well, those days, you wore glasses, you had a bomber jacket, and you had short hair. So when I saw you on this tour, I was like, dude, that guy's a liar.
Yeah.
That wasn't in he wasn't in Trans Am.
People want to be me.
Just which you?
Ooh, I don't know.
but it was I mean, I loved your band. I loved you guys. Like, the first two albums was what I got locked in on you guys with. And so those are the albums I remember. But then now, talking to you on this tour, I didn't realize you've put out all these other albums.
Oh, my God. I think 12 bad. Studio albums, one live album, and a compilation.
Okay. Well, I got to catch up.
And I got to say, like, I'm not – this sounds really weird, but I think we've maintained a pretty consistent – level of attention. Like, it's not like we're just like, oh, whatever, Trans Am. To our own music. Like, to making the album.
Oh, but I remember when Trans Am had a 2-page gatefold spread in Spin magazine.
Yes, of course, yes.
That was huge.
I know. I'm not saying attention from the media or the people. I'm saying we still pay attention to it. The band.
I'm
saying we still like take it seriously. Is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. There was a period there where we were like almost like, God, there was a buzz for sure.
Oh yeah.
But we were just like a little too weird, and I think we were just a little bit too like irreverent as far as the music business goes.
That I would say is cost a lot of bands, including our band back in the day.
Yeah, we were like, yeah, whatever, fucking, this is stupid. Music business.
Meanwhile,
is stupid.
You're doing the photo shoot for. Spin.
Yeah, I know.
Weren't you guys like supposed to be like? It was like Olivia Newton-John physical, where you're all like.
I think that might have been the alternative press one.
Oh, maybe that was.
And yes, and we were like wearing like tank tops or whatever, and we had the photographer spray us with glycerin water, so we looked like we were like totally like drenched in sweat. Yeah. It was a good photo shoot.
It was. It looked good. I thought you guys were on your way.
I thought we were too, and then I don't know what happened.
Fuck. Well, I'm glad that you're here in Baroness.
Yeah. I mean, I feel insanely lucky that I've still been doing this for, 25 years now?
Here's the thing. I did some research. Is this a bullshit thing? You were studying your PhD in physics?
No, it's true. I was studying a PhD in physics.
Well, then why are you doing this, man?
You know what? This is interesting because, okay, so I was...
Why the fuck are you doing this?
Because here's the thing. When I was in grad school, I felt... Okay, when I was in college... Okay. I was good at math and science and stuff like that. I didn't really have to try too hard. In college, I got a scholarship for that, and I got my degree, my undergraduate degree, and then I was like, well, what do? You get your PhD, and then you become a professor or a research scientist, right? And so I started the PhD, and then I realized suddenly I'm now with a whole different bunch of people, and these people are all really, really, really crazy smart and really insanely dedicated and really hard workers. And I just was kind of like, hey, maybe this is cool. I don't know. And I didn't really fit in, and it's so crazy competitive. I mean, I can't think of a more... I mean, I use the word macho. I don't mean physically macho. I mean just really, like, I'm the smartest person in the world. That's the attitude that physics PhD candidates have. Like, I'm discovering new truths about reality. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like... And so... And these people are there, you know, every day of the week, working on stuff, studying, whatever. And I was, like, going to band practice. And I just knew...
You're doing a band at the same time?
Yeah, I was still doing Trans Am. So I was like, I'm just going to fall behind, man, you know? Right. And like... And so then Trans Am released our first album with the self-titled, the one with the blue lines. And I was still in graduate school. And then we got invited to tour with Tortoise in America and in Europe. And, Tortoise was pretty big at the time.
Then, they were the biggest. They're the biggest.
Yeah, so we were playing, like, we'd gone from, like, playing small shows in D.C. to, like, playing for 2,000 people with Tortoise in Europe, like, in a couple of months. And I was like, you know what? People like what we're doing with this band, and my idea was that, like, being in graduate school just requires hard work. It doesn't require luck. Doing music professionally requires luck and hard work. So I felt like I got to take this luck moment while it lasts, you know? So
you worked it out in your head.
Just yeah. Like I was like, hey, man, I can go back to school in 10 years. But, you know, if all my friends then and now are musicians, and they would all kill for that break.
Yeah.
You know? So I took it. My dad was really pissed off at me for like 20 years, you know? Yeah. And then I've been working. I've never had a day job since then. I've been lucky enough to just play drums, which is amazing. But of course, there are days when I wake up and I'm like, oh, should have stayed in grad school, you know? But that, you know, because...
But you can go back.
I mean, at this point, it's kind of like... It's like working out. Like, if you don't go to the gym for 20 years, you know, my brain is not what it used to be as far as math and stuff like that. Like, it's almost like physical work for your brain, you know?
So you have your BA already, right?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's, yeah.
And you have a master's.
No, normally in physics, you go straight from bachelor's to PhD.
Oh, okay.
Because a master's won't get you a job. You have to have a PhD to get any job in physics.
Right, just because it's so high level.
It's up there, yeah. So...
Jesus.
So I do have these thoughts sometimes, like, you know, like, I mean, being a musician is awesome, but it is very, it's scary. If I break my ankle, like, yeah. I'm done. I'm fucked. You know, like,
right,
that's it.
It's like
being an athlete or something. It's really scary, yeah. Right?
Especially as a drummer.
As a drummer. And also, so, like, yeah. If suddenly the band you're in becomes completely uncool.
Right.
It's out of the band's control, you're done.
Yeah.
Right? So it's scary. And so, of course, there are days where I'm like, hey, man, I should have stayed in grad school. But I was doing laundry in Zurich, and I met a physicist who was an American dude. This is 2 weeks ago. And he is a professional physicist who's homeless because he's pushing his own – he's trying to get attention for his own new theory so that one of the big problems in physics is how you can reconcile general relativity with quantum mechanics, which are the two foundations of modern physics. But when they work in their own zones, but when you put them together, they kind of don't meld. So everybody's trying to figure out how to fix that, and he has his own, you know, theory about that. But he's not really getting any traction. So I don't think he's been hired by any university. And this guy was probably like 60. And he's homeless and, like, sleeping on friends' couches and, like, going from university to university trying to get support for his ideas. And it made me think, I'm like, wow, dude, it's really not easy. Even, I mean, the only way to really make money with a PhD in physics is to work for the military-industrial complex.
Right.
Designing bombs. And I didn't want to do that. Right. The other thing you do is you become a professor, which is not easy, or you become a high school teacher, which is nobody's, I don't think it's anybody's first choice in that situation.
Right.
And then if you want to do research, like, the thing is, people have this romantic idea of, like the physicist as, like, the lone genius, Albert Einstein figuring shit out. But nowadays, it's like teams of, like, 300 scientists and, like, crazy amounts of, like, data analysis. And so, like, if you work at, like, CERN, like, the super collider, like, you end up just doing, like, data entry for, like, a team of 500 physicists.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
You're like a PA on a film shoot.
Yeah. So it's just, like, I feel like maybe I'm doing a bit of sour grapes right now. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe it's a good thing that I quit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's that the physicist guy sounds like this, the 50-year-old guy who's trying to peddle his demo to the...
Exactly. Exactly. And it's like, yeah, and it's like, if... I mean, personally for me, like, I'm still a musician because I was lucky enough that people cared what I was doing in my 20s. I would not have pushed it. You know, I would have done something else.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you wouldn't have been the guy knocking on the doors.
No.
People just kind of did it for
you. I mean, you do have to push yourself a little bit.
Yeah,
I'm just saying, you have to put yourself out there. I'm just saying, like, if you're trying for, like, 15 years, that's not, you know, maybe you should do something else.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly. Right.
And I'm not saying you have to be huge. I'm saying if you can't, like, go on tour and make money after 15 years of trying, maybe you do something wrong. I don't know. sounds really negative.
No, but that's the hard truth.
Yeah, totally.
So.
And then I feel like a lot of musicians end up with jobs that they didn't really... Like, jobs, you take jobs because you can work part-time and go on tour, and then that just becomes your life.
it's a part-time job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which was not your first. It was not your second choice. It was your fifth choice.
Oh yeah,
you know what I'm saying, as a job.
Those are the flexible jobs that allow you to tour. We've all done that as musicians, and it's a bit of a dressing down or a humbling when you run into old high school mates, and you're trying to explain to them. Well, you can't give them the whole story,
They're like whatever, running some company and whatever.
There's been a few of those moments in my life.
Yeah, and you're like. Yeah, I'm getting in my van now.
But then now I see them following me on Facebook, so fuck you.
Yeah, fuck them.
Fuck you.
Yeah. They're all miserable in their midlife crisis. We're still rocking.
Right in this fucking smelly
room. Just so the listeners know, we're in we're in an arena in Cologne, and we're in the locker room, shower room.
This is as big as you can get in terms of rock music.
Oh my God, yeah. We're on tour with a band called Volbeat, and they're fucking huge, especially in Germany and Scandinavia. Like, it's 15,000 people every night.
And it's two nights in one city tonight. Cologne.
True. Two nights in one
town. Insane.
It's insane. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
It's a little nerve-wracking at times, honestly, for me.
For you?
Yeah.
Well, you can't handle the big arena crowds? I've been waiting my whole life for this shit.
No, it's just that I don't know how crazy their fans are about Baroness.
Right. I mean, you guys fall under all three of us fall under a different category of hard and heavy.
Yes.
In the hard and heavy world, we all belong.
Yeah.
It's just how receptive certain patches of people are to certain bands.
It's a little rough in general opening up for arena-sized bands.
Always.
Trans Am did a tour opening up for Tool, and we just kept our set short. We played the heavy songs, and I thanked Tool between every song, and that made it okay.
That's what you do in this situation. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the Baroness set is 1 hour, which I think is too long for a direct support in an arena. And it's pretty different from Volbeat. So I think the fans are just, I mean, I don't blame them. They're just, they want to see their favorite band. These people are totally diehard Volbeat fans.
Yeah. Opening up for Volbeat at times is opening up for, Metallica and Slayer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I remember when we opened up for the Rolling Stones, told
the
story.
Whoa, you opened up the Rolling Stones?
Yeah, we did. Sick. See how I slipped it in there,
That's
man?
That's awesome.
Yeah, I just slipped
That's
it in there.
That's great.
No, but we did it.
You haven't slipped that in before.
I do it four or five times per tour.
Nice. Okay, tell me more.
Well, it was in '02, and they were doing their 40 Licks Greatest Hits tour.
Awesome.
And we were chosen to open for them in Toronto. We get up on stage, and everybody's just, you could see it on their face, fuck off.
Was it a stadium show?
No, it was an intimate 1,000 pre-show warm up.
Oh, before the special tickets. And,
the big tour.
Yeah.
So I looked out in the crowd. Everybody wants us to fuck off.
Of course.
So we were in our hometown, and I said, "Listen, you guys, we want to all see the Stones, but right now, kid from Scarborough, kid from Thornhill, kid from Cosenza's, open up for the Stones, man."
Yeah.
And then that got everybody on our side. So you gotta.
You're good with. The stage hype.
Yeah, it's fun.
I know. You're good at it.
Yeah. Being behind the kit, I always find drummers to be frustrated lead singers.
I did do a lot of the in-between stage song stage banter.
Right.
Because I can be kind of rambunctious.
Yeah, I feel drummers that there's always a not in our situation now, but in the past, I always felt there's always a tension between drummers and singers due to this.
Yeah.
This whole who's the bigger front man? Oh, who's the bigger performer?
Right. I mean, Baroness is John's band.
No, I know. But in general, drummers want everybody to look at them much as singers
do. And also in rock or hard rock or metal, drummers are, they can be one of the focal points for sure.
Yeah. That's why there's, Dave Grohl can go back and forth. Yeah, Nicky Anderson goes back and forth.
Yeah.
It's a common thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, and I wanted to drum.
Oh, right. Right on. Yeah. I played bass and guitar in some bands. So
but did you sing? Did you front?
No.
But you fronted Trans Am.
I didn't front Trans Am.
But you were the talking.
I would do the banter sometimes. Yeah. And sometimes we would all do it, which was, I think, was kind of fun.
Yeah,
we'd have little conversations on stage.
I would see. I didn't see you do the banter when we played.
No, that early on, I didn't do it.
Right. Oh. Man, I'm out of touch with you guys in terms of.
I mean, so that was 97 we toured together?
Yeah.
That's 22 years ago.
I'm going to dig up the flyer. I have it. It might be in one of our CDs. Okay. It actually might be in one of the CDs.
That would be awesome.
So I'll dig it up.
And Six Finger Satellite, they were a big influence on Trans Am.
Really?
Yeah, because they had that sort of like DAF and, you know, influence and like and the synths with the rock drums and the bass guitar and sort of like two-way army kind like a punk rock two-way army kind of thing.
Right.
It was very very influential on us.
But didn't you guys come up at the same time?
They were a little more senior than us. They were like a couple of years earlier because we saw them play live at the old Black Cat in DC before our tour.
Right.
And it was a terrifying show. Was it Jay, the singer, right? Right?
I think, yeah.
Yeah, he was like throwing shit from the stage and he's like a huge guy.
He always reminded me of...
They were all dressed up. It was really scary and awesome.
Dressed up like aliens?
I think they're all wearing white.
Oh, okay.
It was fun.
He always reminded me of like Ben Affleck in Dazed and Confused. Remember that movie?
Yeah, I can see
that guy.
Yeah.
Same hair too.
Yeah.
I always looked at him going, wow.
Big head.
Yeah. Like, I hope you're not like that character. But
no, he's cool, dude.
Yeah, but he's definitely like loud and.
Oh, he's very and also physically like
domineering.
Imposing.
Yeah.
He's a big guy.
Yeah.
But they were a great band. Very.
I loved them.
Influential for us.
And, I didn't know that they influenced you.
Oh yeah, and then
I thought it was like Kraftwerk and all that.
Well, yeah,
and all that.
But that shit influenced Six Finger Satellite.
Right.
You know, they were just one of the few bands that were mixing those elements like we were.
Right,
you know,
right.
But and then John McClane became Juan McClane. You know, he has like a dance project, like a house music project. It's actually pretty successful.
See, I don't.
And then James Murphy did an LCD sound system. And James Murphy was their sound man in that era.
Really?
Yes.
So would he have been at the show?
I think we toured more with Six Finger Satellite after that. And James was definitely their sound man.
Maybe not at our shows.
I don't remember.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Well,
small world, huh?
Well, it is a small world. Are they from DC too, or outside?
No. Who?
Six Finger.
They're from Providence.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I always just felt that there was like always a. It was like such a small world from DC and Olympia, Washington, for some reason.
Yeah, people moved back and forth.
It was so weird. Back. Why? Because it's both say Washington.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's so weird.
They both had like political underground punk rock scenes. I think is.
Yeah, but sure, but just those two cities going back and forth.
I don't know why specifically those two towns, but yes, it's true. There was a big crossover.
Okay, now you're saying about you brought up these EDM projects. You have your own project.
I would hesitate to call it EDM because I think even though it is technically electronic dance music,
I know people get. It has ruffled feathers over that.
EDM is more like it has a connotation of like really mainstream like music.
Oh, does it?
Music.
Well,
fest.
I'm a mainstream dance fan.
Okay.
Well, see, I don't know anything. Well, then, was what I'm saying.
Juan McClane is John's alter ego, which is it's kind of like house music basically,
okay.
but cool underground weird, with a bit of other influences, you know. I mean, he's a smart guy. He's he knows his music history.
Yeah, I think all the smart punk rockers got into house music.
Yeah, I mean Steve Gamboa, amongst others, and then
he's got his own thing.
I don't know what he's doing now, but he definitely was DJing for a while.
Oh, what spinning records?
Yeah.
He wasn't making dance music. Was
I don't think he was making it. I think he was just throwing parties.
Oh, so he's like a.
Just getting in that world, you know.
Oh, I see.
But this is a while ago. It was almost 20 years ago, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I think I slept at his house once.
Right, okay.
I think.
So, yeah, so Publicist is that thing. It's like I lived in England for 5 years, and going to parties, to warehouse parties there, it really opened my eyes. So like, hey, you can go to a warehouse party where there's a DJ that's playing interesting underground dance music, and the people that are there are people that you're friends with, are not douchebags.
Right.
Because in America, a lot of clubbing is pretty fucking lame.
Night of the Roxbury type.
Exactly.
Thing.
Right. So that's what I was like, oh, cool. Like, this is like another version of like a punk rock scene.
Right.
Except that there's dancing.
Okay, I get it.
And all DJs. Right. And everybody there is cool and smart and interesting but just having fun. So that inspired me, and I said to myself, you know, I know how to use MIDI. I know how to program beats. I know how to mix. And I also know how to drum. So my idea was, I would program the bass lines and the chords. Just press play on that with a sequencer or whatever situation, and then I would have a click track in my ears, and I would just play drums on the dance floor instead of using a drum machine.
Right.
Because a lot of like live, you know, electronic performances are somebody presses play on the drum machine, and then they play synth with their fingers.
You don't see movement.
Right. So I said, why not do the opposite? Press play on the bass line,
right,
and play drums with your physicality, right? Which I think is more fun to watch than somebody playing a little keyboard.
It's why I can't get into
it's way
watching
more physical.
Dance DJs.
Well, I agree, and that's why I don't watch them.
Yeah.
Ideally, when I go to these parties, you're just interacting with the other people who are partying. You're not watching the DJ. That, to me, is very weird, how young people stare at the DJ.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not the point. It's just some dude jumping up and down in front of his laptop. Like, who cares? It's dumb.
I think so, too.
Yeah. But anyway, so I was doing publicist for a while, and that, when I was living in London, actually, it was reasonably successful. Every weekend, I would go to Europe. I'd play Friday and Saturday, and then I would go back to London and hang out during the week, and then do it again, and just play these weird little parties in France or Germany, and it was pretty cool. It was fun. And then I moved back to America, and it kind of fell apart. Because in America, like, the promoters are much more, for better or worse, are much more specific, and this night is going to be like second generation Detroit techno. This night's going to be like first generation Chicago acid house. It's like very specific. And what I was doing was just like my own weird conglomeration. And I think in New York, that doesn't work. They want they're very knowledgeable and specific about their scene, about their subcultures, you know? So I came back to New York, and publicists started petering out, and then Baroness happened.
Okay.
And here I am. Publicist is still a thing. It's on the back burner.
Did you put anything out?
I put out an EP a year ago with Igor Cavalera from Sepultura, who played percussion on it, because he's also into this kind of shit.
That I know. His mix hell, I follow.
Exactly. And we're buddies, and we send files to each other and collaborate and stuff.
What? I didn't know any of this.
Small world, once again.
Oh, wow. So how did you hook up with Igor?
We hooked up because I'm friends with an act called Paranoid London from London, which is sort of a new acid house. They're really good. I highly recommend them. Paranoid London. And they came to see Baroness in London, and they brought Igor, and we hung out, and then I kept on running into him at metal fests or hard rock fests. And then we just started, then we're like, hey man, let's do something together. So he has a label, so we did some tracks together, and yeah.
So Publicist is out on Igor's label?
Yeah, Delayed Records.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. You know, it's like...
Publicist just got cooler to me.
Yeah. It's just like there's multiple things that are cool in music. And and personally for me, like, I like to sort of like... I get... Like, when I go home, like, I've been playing drums for 10 weeks now with Baroness, I definitely want to start filling with my synths when I go home. You know, I like to sort of like change it up a little bit.
Right.
You know.
So what, more publicist?
Right, exactly. Right. Like, you just need like a breath of fresh air artistically, aesthetically, you know, sometimes.
Oh, yeah. No, I get it.
You know, and...
I've got a noise album.
Oh, really?
On the works. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's like, there's... I mean, if you're... Musicians are not as... close-minded as fans think sometimes, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is also being the opening band. And we felt this more in America than in Europe.
Yeah.
But I find the crowd doesn't realize that the opening bands are there because the the band, the headlining band, wants them there.
Sure, of course, I know.
They don't understand.
They think it's a sporting match, and you're supposed to root for the headliner.
I know. They don't realize that we're all friends. it's weird.
It's so weird.
And it's like, I mean, you guys go over way better than we do. Baroness is just a little too introspective and weird and moody for this night, you know?
Maybe.
Which is funny to say, because it's not, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that introspective and moody, just compared to Volbeat and Danko.
I think people who are coming to this arena show to see Volbeat don't want to get introspective
at that moment. I totally agree. And last night we cut out one of the ballads, and I think it was a good idea.
Mm.
We switched it up for a rocker. And
I mean, we do that when we're playing some sort of.
Totally.
We're going to be at a heavy metal show.
I do think you need to tailor.
Yeah.
A little bit.
We're not going to play the whoa whoa yeah songs. We're just going
to
play the half step songs.
Yeah, of course. Like it's like, yeah, you don't want to antagonize everybody. Just try to work with the evening.
Yeah.
You know, be conscious of the context.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the people who come to see a Volbeat show who maybe know a little bit more about music and can place Baroness in proper context, enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, there's always people. I mean, our goal with this tour was not to, you know, do a normal Baroness tour. It was to try to introduce ourselves to new people. And these are big crowds. And the number we always threw out was like, if 10% of the crowd likes us, that's 1,000 people that have never heard you before who might go check you out on Spotify or come next time we play or buy an album or whatever. Tell their friends, whatever.
Yeah, like we go on, really, we're first on. The arena isn't full. And yet that's about 5 to 6 sold out nights worth of people if we were to play on our own in that city.
Totally.
So, like, we're happy to do it.
Yeah, of course.
But we've been on the receiving end. We've been the opening band when everybody's yelling out the name of the headliner while I'm trying to.
It's really
fucking.
It's funny, man.
And I come across as somewhat of a heel a lot of the time, and so.
No, but I think you do the right thing. You come off. You're like an entertainer on stage. You're like coaching the crowd.
But I think sometimes. When I'm screaming at the crowd, some people mistake it for me yelling at them. At least in our experience in America.
Okay.
And they don't like that.
On this tour, it's worked.
In this tour, I think people get it. But also, like, I'm yelling out you guys and Volbeat. And,
yeah.
And I'm honestly thankful that they showed up as early as we go on.
Like, yeah, and then Volbeat. And everyone's like, yeah. And you're like, and then Baroness. And it's like.
for when I say your name,
and then,
well, I will admit that I've been saying your name. I say your name, and then I quickly say yeah.
Right.
So I do the cheering myself.
Just to cover up.
Yeah, I do the cheering myself.
The crickets.
I do. I've been doing that for the past week, but there's not crickets. I mean, there's people who want to see you.
I know. I'm exaggerating.
You know, the tendency is to focus on the one person who's got their arms folded at all times.
Yeah, I mean. It is a very good experience for me though, because like one can get really spoiled doing your own tours all the time, playing for your small room of dedicated fans. Because like, you know, like you tune your snare drum and it was like, oh, or like John changes his guitar pedal. Ooh.
Yeah.
Nobody gives a shit here.
Nope.
You know, like you gotta.
This is the great equalizer.
You gotta work.
Yeah.
You know?
I remember we did it. We opened up for Nickelback.
Wow.
That is everybody's reaction.
They're Canadian, right?
Yeah, we did it in Canada.
Yeah, how was that?
I mean, for us, it was amazing.
Yeah.
We're a band. We've been playing clubs, urine-smelling clubs, and, you know, dicks on the wall.
Yeah.
And then suddenly we're playing every NHL arena in Canada. We were fucking. We didn't care if people were making fun of us because we were on tour with Nickelback. People still make fun of us for that.
Right.
But they don't understand that a band that's been, like, you know, sitting in clubs with dicks on the wall for fucking 15 years will fucking love to do it.
Of course. You can't be too cool for school.
Well, we weren't the first band asked to do that tour.
Oh, so some people were.
People turned it down. To turn down an arena tour is who do you think you are?
Yeah, it's. I mean. The music exists because people listen to it, you know, and there's so many great drummers we'll never hear because they don't leave their practice space.
Yeah,
there's so many great songwriters in their bedroom who have made these killer albums that we're never going to hear because they're just too cool or too shy or too whatever to put it out there. So it kind of it's like a moot point, you know.
Yeah.
If you don't put it out there.
Yeah. No, I was going to make a point, but yeah. No, it's true. You just got to go out and do it.
Definitely. And you know, we'll see next summer when we come back for festivals if more people know who the hell we are because of this tour. I mean, I do feel like we've also made some, like, people that hate us now that have never heard of us. But that's fine. They weren't going to be fans anyway.
You didn't lose anybody.
Exactly. They were already not part of our thing. So
yeah, I think the reason for being on this tour for you guys is the right reason.
Yeah. We're also learning about how to play a bigger stage in a bigger room. You know, like, we're starting to use wireless now, stuff like that. You know, it's a different beast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
When Trans Am played with Tool, were they doing these size arenas?
Yeah, it was
back even back then.
It was Canada and Western Canada, Western U.S., and it was ice hockey arenas.
Right, because yeah, Tool was are like, on tour now and they're doing arenas.
18,000 people every night.
Right. Oh my god,
it was terrifying. And Tool fans are completely dedicated.
Yeah, they're single-minded.
Single-minded, yeah. But yeah, I would say like, yeah, I want to thank Tool between every song, and it was I didn't give them a chance to boo us.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, before the booing could start, I would thank Tool.
That's what you got
to
do.
But, I mean, Tool fucking loves us, especially Danny. I mean, we're still buddies. We hang out. He comes to see Trans Am play, you know.
Oh, well, then that's great.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You should reunite and jump on this tour they're on.
I should. I should ask him.
Whoa, did I just did I just hatch something?
Maybe. If you're talking about Trans Am, I think Phil and Nate are like... I think they're pretty settled.
But a Tool tour?
Yeah. I don't know. I think they're pretty settled.
Okay.
You know.
Well, hey, and I don't know if you're my first. No, you're not my first. I'm pretty sure there's been a couple other guests on who are a Grammy nominated guest.
Yes.
So, that was weird. Wow, what an honor.
Oh, it was super weird. It was awesome. Weird.
Yeah, I mean, an honor for the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I don't know. Yeah, it was. The short story about that is that, of course, we were like, we're obviously not going to win this, but we're going to go because.
Who were you up against?
Okay, Megadeth, Gojira, Periphery.
Periphery. Wow.
And fuck. And Korn.
Is it the year Megadeth won?
Yes.
Okay, I know that year. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we were like, obviously, we're not going to win this, right? Mm-hmm. But we're going to go to L.A. and party and wear weird suits. So yeah. That was awesome. We were red carpet, interviews, photos. It was, like, super fun.
That's cool.
We all have friends in L.A. It was really fun and silly and like, a weird moment. And then we go to the auditorium because the metal category is during the day.
Yeah, of course.
And so – and we're all sitting there. And then, like, you know, there's 100 categories. And it starts getting closer and closer to the best metal performance. And suddenly we're, like, looking at each other and we're like, well, wait – what if we actually win? Like, we hadn't thought of it. And suddenly you realize you're like one out of five bands. It might actually happen. And we started panicking. We're like, what do we do? Like, what the hell? Like, we hadn't prepared anything, right?
Right.
And then you start getting more and more excited, and then they announced Megadeth as the winner. And so three funny things. First of all, we all were like, fuck! Which is funny, because literally half an hour before, we were like, there's no... A, I don't care about winning. B, there's no way we're going to win.
Right.
And then as soon as they mentioned Megadeth, we're like, God damn it, you know?
Right, right, right.
The other funny thing is Korn immediately stood up and walked out.
Oh, wow.
And the third funny thing is that as Megadeth walked down to the stage to receive their award, the house band started playing Master of Puppets by Metallica.
I heard about that.
And we were all like, oh, my God.
Oh,
like,
my God.
And we didn't know if it was an accident or if they were sort of like... needling them or what?
I couldn't have been that.
I think it was an accident. I think they're like, oh, this is a really famous metal song.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think he's got writing credit on it.
Oh, right.
They might have just like looked it up.
Oh, it's possible. Yeah.
I think he does.
I don't know.
I know he has writing credit on two tracks on Master.
Okay, that's a good point. That's funny, man.
That's crazy.
And then Dave Mustaine was like, in his speech, yeah, this is, I think he said it was like their 12th nomination.
All right.
So.
And the first win? And the first
Yeah,
win.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you got 11 more to go.
Yeah, so I mean, look, here's the thing. It was really fun. It's a really big honor, especially because a lot of the people that vote are other bands, which is awesome. But having said all that, I've never once in my life
has anybody ever said to me, you got to check out this band, they just won a Grammy?
Yeah, yeah.
Never. In fact, if anybody ever would have said that to me, I would have been like, yeah, I'll pass.
Yeah.
You know, so it, in that sense, who cares? It is fun and it is an honor. And it's great to tell your parents, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, for a band like Megadeth, it's like, I guess...
It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, really. They have to have it. Because if they don't...
I mean, that's... For a while, the joke was that the metal category was like a lifetime achievement award. Because it usually went to a classic band. But then they started... Now they're doing Mastodon one, High on Fire one. So now they're doing more contemporary.
I mean, Gojira... All the other nominees are pretty new. Yes. You guys, Gojira...
Totally.
Periphery? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Are they Australian? Canadian?
I don't think Periphery are Canadian.
Shit. Yeah, I don't remember.
I don't think they are.
But yeah, it was fun.
Maybe they are.
Yeah, I don't know.
Fuck, I gotta check.
On the periphery of America.
There you go. Is that how we end it?
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Danko. It was my pleasure.